I'd like now to welcome to the program Arun Gupta. He is a founding editor of The Independent. He's a regular commentator on Democracy Now! And Grit TV, and he's one of the founding editors of the Occupy Wall Street Journal, and Michelle Fawcett, who is an adjunct professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University. The two of them are traveling all around the country covering the Occupy movement for Alternet and Salon.com. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be with you.
And welcome to Santa Fe.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you're truly, you've covered thousands of miles going from one place to another, and I've been reading some of your articles in Salon about Occupy, and for example, I didn't even know there was Occupy Mobile, Alabama. There's Occupy movements in, 300 different cities?
Yes, at least 300 active occupations. There are other occupations across the country, maybe numbering as many as 1,600, but they aren't necessarily making a constant presence on street corners. There are people that may come out with signs on a Saturday or something like that. But there are 300 active occupations, and we've now been to 20.
What have the ones been like, for example, in Mobile, in southern states, and specifically in so-called conservative states that you've been to?
Yes, Occupy Mobile actually only held a public space for about 3 days before the police came in and removed them from the space.
Were you there?
We were not there. We were there a couple days after. The amazing thing about Occupy Mobile is that none of these people knew each other prior to meeting and prior to establishing an Occupy movement there. They were attracted to the Occupy Wall Street movement, and each of them knew that they were some kind of a what they call black sheep in their conservative community. And so when they heard about Occupy Wall Street, they got together and they formed an occupation. They took over a space, like I said, for 3 days. And what was remarkable is that it was sort of a coming out, a political coming out for these people. They did not feel like they were part of their conservative community. They all knew that something was wrong with the system, so to speak. They knew that there was a great amount of injustice in society. And when they came together, they recognized each other. And now they are not so concerned about having physical space because they found a community, and a political community, and a community that expresses their interest in creating a more just society.
It really is like a coming out. Or it sounds also like Betty Friedan in the 1960s, women knowing there's something wrong and coming together and finding out what it is. That's fascinating. And what are, when you were, for example, in Mobile and some of these other southern states, what's the community like? Is it young people? Is it racially mixed? What are you looking at?
Well, the people that we met with, and this was late one night in a suburb far from Mobile, the people that we actually met with were about 20 individuals, and they were mostly young and they were mostly white. So I can't really speak to who else is part of that particular movement, but they were, for the most part, young. There was a middle-aged woman there who was a former worker in the shipyard industry along the Gulf Coast. And she was also very much a part of that movement. So, but they found it just incredible that that community could actually get along with each other, that they had shared interests, that they immediately felt like they were part of one family.
It's interesting because there's been, for years, a lot of hand-wringing about why it is that people vote against their own economic interests. And here you are finding people whose, it seems like the key was just simply coming together and talking.
Yeah, I think that's very much true. I think that the whole thing about economic interest gets very complicated because the thing about the Occupy Wall Street movement, it is very much an idea, and it starts with the economic crisis. But it's also about it's a domination of our system by corporations, but not just our economic system, it's our political system. And so there are very clear demands that people are making, despite what is said. People everywhere, we've been to 20 occupations now across the country, are saying get corporate money out of politics, separate corporations from the state, stop the corruption of our government and democracy. But at the same time, people also want to engage in democratic practices. And that's one of the things that's wonderful about it is people come into these public spaces, the occupations, they engage in the General Assembly. And for the first time in their life, they're seeing, oh, this is what democracy really is. It's not this system of smoke and mirrors, this dog and pony show that's voiced foisted upon us, where we get to choose between two candidates who've been already selected by Wall Street. You know, that's what the democracy really is. And so through this, they're finding community and even talking about building a new society. And so it then starts to address deeper human needs that people didn't even realize, that we live very much in an alienated consumer society. You know, that people are taught and it's beaten in their heads, you as a social being are only a consumer. And what the Occupy movement has done is give people a different sense of themselves, a different sense of community, a different sense of society. So that's why the whole issue, I think, of whether it's just about economic interests becomes a lot more complicated, because people may appear to be voting against their economic interests, and I would argue they are, but often they're voting in what they see as their social and cultural interests. You know, like for the Tea Party, the notion of there's a possessive interest in whiteness. The Tea Party, which I've studied, which I've gone to meetings, is very much it's a reactionary white movement. It's a real movement, but it's a reactionary white movement. And people get some sort of psychological, social, cultural investment of whiteness from being in this movement. And that's why it gets very complicated. And we can't reduce these movements to just economic factors, and particularly the Occupy Wall Street movement. The reason it's been so effective is it touches these deeper social, psychological, community needs.
There is something that happens sometime in the media when people want to compare current events to things that they know from the past. And so they'll compare this to the 60s and they'll talk about hippies and stuff like that. And one of the things that strikes me about this movement is the differences between this and the 1960s. And one of them, and correct me if I'm wrong here, because I haven't been to all these movements that you've been to, is that it seems to be very much inclusive of whoever wants to be in it and doesn't seem to have a kind of us and them, like, this is our culture, the culture of our movement, if you're not in that, you're square, or something like that. I mean, the whole framing of the 99% basically says everybody is in this. What is it actually like? Do you feel that there is a kind of culture on the ground in these different places that's common when you go from one to another?
Yes, I absolutely think that there is. The Occupy Wall Street movement is about being excluded from having control over your own economic reality, the ability to have any effect through the electoral process. People are feeling that casting a vote for their interests is not resulting in anything that actually changes their lives. They don't have any sort of public forum to go to talk with other people about these ideas. They're basically feeling extremely isolated and alienated. So since that is the core part, really the reason for why people are coming out on a very sort of emotional level, that they're driven to come out to make community. So since that is the driving purpose of the movement, that is very much what you'll find when you go to the occupations, is that everybody is very excited about being a part of something, and they actively make that room for other people to come in, no matter who that person may be, including the homeless,
right,
including the poor, including the elderly, including the disabled, black or white, male or female.
But, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is they don't dress alike. They don't necessarily have common music and things like that.
Well, and I think that's one of the interesting things about the movement. It's the movement that created the 99%. There was no discussion about the 99% before the Occupy Wall Street movement. And it creates these certain contradictions, because we've been used to this language for decades now about the middle class. Our political rhetoric is all about the middle class. And one of the things the Occupy movements had to confront very early on is that they were going into spaces that were already occupied. They were occupied by the homeless. In so many cities that we've been to, we heard the same thing again and again. And so then you have to deal with the reality. The movement does, I think, start as largely a youth movement, a young, white-led, often college-educated movement. But it becomes such a powerful idea. Everyone can pour their concerns and say, you know, if it's about unemployment or housing or I lack health care or I can't, you know, I'm an unemployed factory worker, whatever your issue, you can pour it into Occupy Wall Street and see it as legitimate. So you do create this just amazing representation of the whole society, and it does create conflicts and contradictions on the ground. For instance, when we were in New Orleans, they had a really good occupation going, but New Orleans is also, it's a damaged city. It's a really severely damaged city. You notice the damage to the infrastructure is enormous, even though it's been over 6 years after Katrina, but you start to notice the social and psychological damage. So they were having difficulties early on. Someone was telling us they were having 5 to 6 fistfights a night
at
the occupation. And one person was saying, like, every night, one person another was screaming, "I'm going to kill you." But they've been working through that. And one of the organizers is like, look, you know, what this does is this occupation, it shows the society as it actually is. And one of the things I've been saying is what these do is they essentially rip the scabs off society, the occupations, and they show what our society is actually really like, because we're used to pathologizing poverty in terms of you see individuals on the street and they're always isolated, and we see they're homeless because of personal choices. And this is part of the dominant ideology of Reaganism, of neoliberalism, that's dominated not just our economy but our ideas over 30 years. It's all about personal responsibility. If you're poor, it's your own fault. If you don't have health care, Herman Cain said this recently, if you're not rich, it's your own fault. And so this is what we're taught. But when you gather all these poor and homeless people together in one place, and they can actually start to work together and live together, there may be conflicts. They're coming with a lot of baggage of having lived on the streets, but a lot of them are also still very sane, and they're all people. And you start to see, for one, it's not an individual issue. It's a process of social production, that we have put specific policies and laws in place that creates poverty, that creates mental illness. It's extremely difficult. People's psyches shatter from having to live on the street, from having gone from, you know, we've talked to many people who were factory workers, who had houses, and people who said, I used to have a beautiful life, and now they live in poverty or are on the street.
Not to mention veterans.
That's one of the remarkable things. We've met veterans at virtually every occupation that we've been to. And so it's this really amazing cross-section of society. But it does create difficulties at some of these occupations. But at the same time, this is what our society really is. And if we're going to heal our society and create a better society, we need to confront it head on. And this is what's happening at so many of these occupations, that they are collectively working through problems as a community. And that's why this movement is so important on so many different levels.
And do they have, for example, facilitators and mediators and people like that who can work with, for example, the dudes who want to have fist fights?
Yeah, they do. In New Orleans, what were they calling it? They had some sort of like peace or resolution committee where it was specifically trying to resolve these different issues. But then it does also create this whole other conflict, that the occupations, while they want to welcome people in, they can't act as social service organizations. You know, it doesn't matter how much money you have. You could have $1 billion. The need is so great that money will just fly out the door quickly. Occupy Wall Street has $500,000. But in a place like New York City, the amount of people who live in poverty is something like over 2 million people. That money could be gone in less than a day if they were able to disperse it. So they can't act as organizations that are trying to provide specific needs, you know, provide bedding, provide housing, provide food. What many have on their own come to the conclusion is they'll say to people who come to them and want these things, we'll provide you with these things, but you have to become part of the movement. And usually many of them will feed anyone who asks, no questions, with no obligations. But if you want more, then you have to participate and be part of this movement. And so many areas we've heard, you know, some of our most important organizers, people who are really making this movement strong, are homeless people.
We're talking to Arun Gupta and Michelle Fawcett about the Occupy movements all around the country. What you're saying points out the reality that in electoral politics, you never hear, for example, presidential or senatorial candidates talking about poverty, or rarely. You hear them talking about the middle class, as if the middle class were the poor. And this movement is giving us a chance to actually look up close at issues of poverty, both on the ground in the Occupy movement and, we hope, in the media.
Yeah, absolutely. The Occupy movement has definitely shown a spotlight, really, on the poor and the homeless that have really been invisible for a very long time. So I think when you hear a lot of criticism about violence or other issues inside the Occupy camps with the homeless people, it's really because we're not used to seeing them. We're not used to seeing them at all. Not as human beings, not as anybody that is actually visible on the street. So when you go into the Occupy camps and you see what's happening there, a light is being shown on poor people and homeless people for the first time in many, many years. So.
And the other thing is also there was that recent incident where in Oakland where someone who may have been at the Occupy camp was shot and killed by someone else at the Occupy camp. And the mayor, Gene Kwan, and other elected officials were trying to use that as an excuse. We need to shut it down. It's like, well, that was the 91st person who was murdered in Oakland that year, so should we shut down the whole city of Oakland? And this is a thing that to expect that you're going to have these just pure utopian movements spring up out of the ground is ridiculous. The exposure of what society is like is not always going to look pretty, but we need to confront that this is not the fault of the occupations, it's actually a gift from the occupations that is making us confront this is what the type of society we are creating, and we need to change it.
Yeah, I mean, if it were pretty, we wouldn't need a movement in the first place.
Exactly.
So you wrote a very interesting article about the middle class and the American dream, and I think there's a lot of kind of confusion about those concepts, like the middle class is a wonderful thing that needs to keep strong and keep from being attacked and eroded, and the American dream is something that we need to reinvigorate, the whole Van Jones thing. You have a different perspective on that.
Well, yeah, it's there are certain writers, especially, I think, who promote this. Very, very smart people. Paul Krugman, the guy is brilliant, but he has this very idealized notion of the middle class. He talks a lot about the era of the 1950s, not surprisingly, an era that he grew up in. He calls it, I think it's the Great Convergence. And what he means by this is that the income levels started to converge, but even though Krugman is absolutely a genius, he gets loopy when he talks about the era of the 50s and 60s. He writes in one article, there were no great extremes of wealth or poverty. And I just want to tell him, really? There were no Rockefellers or sharecroppers?
In the
1950s?
Like, what was Martin Luther King doing?
Yeah, yeah. And so it's this idealized notion of what was going on in the post-World War II era was you had steadily increasing incomes in conjunction with productivity because of what's known as the social compact. Organized labor kept the peace. In other words, they engaged in the McCarthyist purges of socialist, communist, anarchists from the unions. In return, they got wage increases from productivity increases. So it means you had a growing middle class, growing prosperity, a growing consumer society. This all starts to break down by the 1970s, but it was a notion that we could all be middle class, that everyone could enjoy this prosperity, that you could have this single earner household, and you could have a secure home and health care and have the vacation and get the new car every 2 or 3 years. And people idealize this. Why can't we just return to it? And for one, I was like, look, let's look at what this history is. For one, like I said, it's McCarthyism. It was this era of just really brutal ideological witch hunt that destroyed the lives of tens and hundreds of thousands of people by purging them from the unions, from academia, from cultural industries like Hollywood, Broadway, publishing, and all that. Secondly, it was a system of American apartheid, plus the extreme rural poverty. Michael Harrington wrote the famous book, The Other America, in the 1960s. And interestingly, the last politician to talk about this was John Edwards in the 2008
That's right.
campaign, where he talked about the two Americas. Of course, you know, we know what a phenomenally flawed individual he is. And it's unfortunate his message didn't get out there further, but he was really talking about the fact that there are two Americas. But Michael Harrington talked about this, you know, the urban poverty, the rural poverty that existed. It was also a time that was incredibly suffocating for women, for anyone who was gay, lesbian, or had another sexual identity. Women were forced into these very strict social roles, gender roles, sexual roles, you know, the great Rolling Stone song, Mother's Little Helper, summed it all up.
What, you know, pills you can take to keep yourself from...
From being depressed, because you have the, you went to college, got this great education, and now you're spending your life changing diapers and washing dishes. So what is so ideal about this society? But more important, this was during the era of the Cold War, and our prosperity was based on plunder from the underdeveloped world. So, you know, it meant...
And still is.
And, of course, it still is. It's except it's only the rich who now enjoy the plunder. What happened in the post-World War II era is that the plunder was being spread a bit more evenly. And this meant things like toppling the government of Guatemala because of the interests of United Fruit Company for bananas, toppling Iran for the oil, toppling Chile for copper, just these genocidal campaigns that were waged in Indonesia for things like I think bauxite, you know, the brutality of the governments in Bolivia just because they were supplying tin, and on and on and on, all these raw materials that were flowing into the U.S. that was propping up our economic system.
Not to mention the fact that Japan and Germany and really all of Europe were rubble heaps.
Right.
And so we had no competition.
Right. And that's why by the early 1970s, this system starts to fall apart for a number of reasons. One of them is that Japan and Germany were economic competitors. But more important is that the social movements from the 1960s, after demanding and starting to achieve a democratic voice, and this is a thing that I actually wanted to say about the Occupy Wall Street movement, we need to see it in this context of hundreds of years of movements that are demanding and enlarging what democracy is. And that was, of course, what was going on in the 1960s for the African-American community, for women, for other oppressed minorities like Latinos, Native Americans, the whole gay rights, gay liberation movement that came out of the 1960s. But they started to demand this slice of the pie as well, and not just in the U.S., but throughout a lot of the world, that it's like, if we can give this to, you know, the iconic white male head of household, the good paying job with benefits, why can't we spread this around society? And then, of course, this is where it starts to get complicated. You also had the war economy, and that was starting to drain the budget. And so, essentially, the profits were falling. And what was happening by the early 1970s is that people who held bonds, and this is what it's always about. It's always about the bondholders. This economic crisis is about the bondholders. What we were doing was bailing out people who owned the bonds and stocks of governments and corporations. So by the early 1970s, the bondholders were seeing negative rates of return because their interest they were getting was below the inflation rate. And so this is when you really start to see the concerted counterattack by the early 1970s. It's when the Heritage Institute is founded, the World Economic Forum is founded a few years earlier. There's a famous memo by, I think it was Powell, one of the Supreme Court justices, I think it was Powell, before he was on the Supreme Court, where he was talking about how the business community needed to essentially fund a whole network of think tanks. And that's what we see during the 70s as the right starts to build its capacity, resulting in Reaganism and Thatcherism. And so we can't just turn back the clock. And I think this was the whole problem with the Obama phenomena in 2008. And just as the Tea Party people idealized the American Revolution, a lot of leftist liberals and progressives idealized the New Deal and post-World War II prosperity. And there are real problems with it, for one. And two, you can't turn back the clock, because the fundamental problem is, even though you can put regulations in place, and this is what happened, we had better regulations in place of capitalism, of capital controls, of the banking sector during the 1950s and 60s. As long as you leave the corporate form, let it exist, what you do is you have these board of directors, these executives, who have the means, the money, and the motivation to overturn all these regulations. And so this is what we've seen precisely after the most recent economic crisis, where everything was screaming for regulation of the banks, that we needed to break up the too big to fail banks. And what we've seen result, because the banks are throwing hundreds of millions of dollars into lobbyists, into political campaign contribution, into advertising. In fact, it's probably in the billions of dollars that they pretty much gutted the regulation that came out of this economic crisis a year or two ago. There are all these loopholes in it. Everyone who analyzes the system critically says, all we've done is create bigger, too big to fail banks.
Right.
And so this is why, if you don't address the corporate form, regulation does not fundamentally work. And this is also one of the issues within the Occupy Wall Street movement, that you have these different segments of people. Some are anti-capitalist, some are just anti-corporate. But I think the great majority think we just need better regulation of corporations, where what I would say to them is, that ain't going to work. We've been there, done that, it failed, and you can't turn the clock back. You know, so you can't just think you can recreate this, put a few more regulations in, and everything's going to be fine. You got to root out the rot, which is, at minimum, the corporations, if not capitalism.
We're talking to journalists Arun Gupta and Michelle Fawcett, talking about the Occupy movements all over the country. The two of them are traveling around the country covering the Occupy movement for Alternet and Salon.com. One of the things that is also different from the 1950s and that sort of pseudo-golden era that people like to talk about is that we have decimated our natural resources. And I don't know to what extent, I hear less about this, but I don't know to what extent the Occupy movement is taking on climate change and environmental degradation.
They are. There's quite a few people at different occupations that have the environment as their primary concern. We've talked to people in Philadelphia who had this as a concern. We've talked to people certainly in West Virginia, where mountaintop removal and the Marcellus Shale situations are causing a lot of environmental devastation, causing water supplies and food supplies to become toxic. And this is in a state that's been really economically devastated for some time. So the people are not really prepared to deal with the environmental problems. So that is very much an issue that is discussed. I think a lot of people don't realize that the Occupy movements, while they do have all of them have this concern with corporate greed, with corporate control over government, they also have their own specific issues. So every Occupy that we've been to has had very specific issues specific to their local communities. So and the environment is definitely one of them in many of the Occupy camps.
What are some of the other site-specific, so to speak, interests that the Occupy movements have been bringing to light?
Well, in just continuing on the environmental theme, in New Orleans, certainly the BP Deepwater Horizon spill is a really big issue down there. We were at Youngstown, Ohio, which was a very inspiring occupation. They were campaigning against Issue 2, which would repeal the law passed, championed by the Republican governor that was passed, and it did successfully help repeal it, that's effectively stripped collective bargaining rights from the 350,000 state workers. They were also campaigning against hydrofracking in a local park that everyone's called the jewel of the area, a really beautiful park, but which the state wants to allow hydrofracking in. In Toledo, it was an issue of abandoned housing. That's a big issue almost everywhere, was abandoned housing. One of the ways to understand an economic crisis is it's always about surplus. So economically, when you have a crisis, you have idle factories, in other words, surplus capacity, and then you have idle workers, is surplus workers. And in the kind of cold, brutal language of neoclassical economics, you need to destroy the surplus. Of course, what does that mean? Well, it's easy to destroy a factory, but it's pretty ugly to destroy human beings, but that's kind of what's going on. So with housing, we always hear, oh, there's excess housing stock. And if you read financial news and websites, investing websites, they always talk about the housing market's not going to recover until we destroy the excess capacity. Yet the crazy thing in this country is you have millions of abandoned homes, many of which are inhabitable or could easily be made inhabitable again. But you have also something like 10% of the population, it varies from area to area, who are doubling up. Technically, you could argue those people are homeless. The number of people who live on the street is maybe about a million or so. But you have all these families doubling up now. You have all these kids who are having to move back home after college. You have multi-generational households, two or three generations under the same roof. And yet a block away or even on the same block, there could be an empty house. And so in Toledo, we talked to some people, you know, who were saying they were involved in a campaign with some of the local unions to try and get the housing stock turned over to the city where people could go in, get some money and fix them up and live in them and just pay the property taxes. And of course, it's a great idea. It makes complete sense, but it's not in the interest of banks. And because it's not in the interest of banks, it's not going to happen except without a big fight. But what it does show is who really controls our system. That it's more important that banks maintain their profits or even the idea of profits than people have housing. So the result is, let those people die on the street, let them live in substandard conditions, you know, doubling up. It's very psychologically destructive, very stressful, bad for people's health, but it's better that this happen than banks lose a little bit of money.
I think it's important to mention also that the local issues are not just issues that are already existing in the community that the Occupy camp is trying to support. There are actually situations where the Occupied camp itself is producing policy recommendations. So, for example, in Toledo, we were just talking about how the Occupied camp there, the occupiers are working with SEIU to possibly take over some abandoned housing and put forward this type of proposal. In Lexington, Kentucky, there is a campaign that was proposed by one of the occupiers, and it's called the Invest in Kentucky campaign, and it was modeled after the Move Your Money campaign, where nationally people were asked to remove their money from corporate banks and bring it back home to the local community bank or credit union. In Lexington, that Occupied movement proposed an Invest in Kentucky campaign where they're going to try to take the state's $12 to $15 billion worth of funds out of Chase Bank, which is, you know, headquartered in New York, and bring it back to a local community bank and then try to make that bank accountable to the community, try to make sure that those funds, which are part of that state, stay in the state, become circulated within that economy, loaned out to start new businesses or to have other projects that could use that type of credit, get investment going. So that is something that actually did come out of the Occupied camp in a specific situation, which really runs counter to the mainstream media, which keeps telling us that these people don't even know what they want. Not only do they know what they want, they're proposing specific policies and acting upon it.
And it's interesting because there is real evidence that banks that work in that way, that work in a responsible way that is not buying and selling derivatives and betting against themselves and each other and all of that stuff, but actually loaning money to people who responsibly pay it back, do better than some of these gamblers.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think it's a good strategy for opening up the debate, and I've talked to some political economists who say, like, this is good for getting people to think more deeply about solutions. But at the same time, it does have limits. It's a little bit of the voting with your dollars or shopping for a better planet.
Right.
You know, I could withdraw. I actually have my money in a credit union in New York City. But say if I was in another bank, I withdrew a few thousand dollars. It's not that that's not unimportant. I have a few thousand dollars to withdraw, whereas Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have about $50 billion to withdraw. So if you're trying to vote with your dollars, the problem is it's still the elite who control the dollars. It's 400 individual Americans, not family, but individuals who have as much wealth as the bottom 60% of the population combined.
So 400. That's way less than
1%. Yeah. It's about 1/10,000 of 1%. It's literally 1 in a million.
Yeah.
You know, where there's 300 million people. So these 400 people have more money than 180 million Americans combined. You know, and so I think it is important, you know, to do things like move your money, support local businesses. But what will really make this movement important is to think deeper about democracy. Democracy is not just in the political sphere. It has to be in the economic sphere. Democracy means having a say and even control over institutions that affect your life, that affect you directly. And why should we leave the workplace out of this? It's the basis of any society is work. So we need to have democracy in the workplace.
So then some really fundamental questions come up, and I love that people are talking about these things like, okay, are we anti-corporate? Are we anti-capitalist? What kind of an economic system do we want? And I was just not too long ago in Boston, I was talking with somebody who was involved with Occupy Boston, and he was saying that he believed in socialism. And I said, well, what do you mean by socialism? And he had a very, borderline hunter-gatherer idea about how economies work. And I thought, rather than get into a huge argument, I'm just going to kind of listen to what he has to say. But the reality is that I think it's complex for a lot of us. I mean, I've said this before. I'm sitting in a cafe in front of a corporate-created mixing board, a Macintosh computer, coffee that came from Lord knows where, and all these things. And a lot of the stuff that we enjoy and that makes our lives better and that could, in theory, fuel a reasonably just economy are things that have a lot of bad stuff attached to them, like oppression and environmental degradation. And how do we think about what we want to keep, what we want to throw out, how we want to change it?
Well, we have to do that collectively and democratically. You know, I was recently asked at a presentation, someone was talking about good corporations, and they mentioned Apple and Facebook. And I was like, are you serious? Facebook, which basically spies on people and sells their data? Or Apple computers? I mean, maybe you want to believe in this myth of Steve Jobs and these creative occupations at Apple, but in fact Apple is really built on Foxconn, which is this Chinese company. It has one of the largest factories in the world. It employs over 100,000 people. They do nothing but build Apple products, and the management of the work is so rigorous and so micromanaged, it creates a very psychologically destabilizing conditions there.
And yet the creativity stuff and the founding of Apple in the 1980s and stuff, you can't just throw that out either. I mean, there's some truth and beauty to that.
Right, it's true. But the thing is, the people who are actually making these products, and I've had plenty of Apple products, I have an iPod now, they were jumping out the windows, killing themselves. And so many were jumping out the windows of the Foxconn plant that the company had two responses. One was to put up nets around the plant, around the buildings, to catch the jumpers. Two was to make all employees sign these pledges that I will not commit suicide, because then if they commit suicide, they will deny their family any benefits. And so this is how your Apple products are put together.
Right.
And let's not even talk about the extraction of all the heavy metals that go into these. You know, it's well known about coltan, which is the heavy metal that's in virtually every electronic device. It's a conflict mineral coming from the Congo, where you have children who are existing in just the most horrendous apocalyptic conditions, sifting this for rivers. And that's what's in your cell phone, your PDA, your computer, whatever, almost any electronic device you have.
And women being raped to open up these areas for mining.
Right. Yeah, so it's we need to allow people to have say in the workplace, and people be like, oh, that'll never work. Well, that's just not true, because of course there are plenty of examples. There's the whole there's plenty of co-ops in this country. There's the Spanish Mondragon movement, which is thousands and thousands of businesses strong. There have been all sorts of successful examples in France and in Italy. Fiat was run as a worker-run corporation for decades. It's not hard to do, but the problem is when you start to do that, when you start to have people not just have a say in the workplace, well, then they're going to want to have a say in investment where the profit goes, and that means you're going to start to cut out the owning class. You'll have a much healthier society, you'll have a better world, but you're not going to have the Warren Buffetts, Bill Gates, Koch brothers, and all the rest, and that's what they're fighting to keep control of.
So if you have worker-owned workplaces, does that mean that you don't have, that those companies are automatically not publicly traded?
Well, that's a whole other issue of public versus private. It could be publicly traded. I would argue that what we should do is, you know, we've had the whole state-owned model. We could also use another model where we could make vital industries not for profits. Our hospital, our medical system, all the Blue Crosses and Blue Shields, you know, I could remember when nearly everyone had good medical care in the late 70s, early 80s. Blue Crosses and Blue Shields were all not non-profits. They've virtually all become for-profits. Our medical industry, the healthcare industry, is a prime example of how corrupting and destructive privatization is.
I also have to say that there's a lot of nonprofit hospitals, we're not going to name any names right now, that are as greedy as the for-profit hospitals.
Right. And you know, another example, it's an unusual example because I don't think we should emulate it, but there is something important there. China. China is completely out-competing us because they actually have national economic policy. What we're told is the most efficient, the best system is one in which private interests make private decisions for private profit. And yet the Chinese will decide we're going to enter wind turbines, solar panels, car battery technology. And within a decade, they will become the global leader because they have national economic planning. We should have economic planning, but it should be democratic economic planning.
And it's so tricky because, I mean, I think when we look at the only industrial models we know, because the industrial system is only barely over a century old, we basically have capitalism and communism, and nobody wants to drive a Yugo or eat, you know, the stuff that came out of state-produced systems. I mean, they're as corrupt and ugly and unattractive or more so than anything that we've produced.
Well, one of the important things that I think is coming out, and it might be the most important thing that's coming out of the Occupy Wall Street movement, is a igniting of the imagination. And so rather than hearkening back to failed models, we're seeing people say, but wait a minute, that was a model that didn't work at that time. Could there be a different kind of model? So at any point when you go to an Occupy and you see people having these kinds of discussions, they are being pushed along by others who are saying, well, what if we were to expand this idea out further to see where, at what point, we might have to make a larger, more systemic kind of change so that it isn't just about regulating or it isn't just about going back to some sort of prior form or model. It's about opening it up and seeing how far changes have to take place in order for the kinds of things, the kind of life that we want, which is one of equality and of justice. So I have to say that an important part of the Occupy movement is the discussions that are taking place beyond sort of past models.
Yeah, very interesting and very important. Now, the next thing that people talk about is, are you going to have the Occupy movement co-opted by the Democrats in the same way that the Tea Party movement was co-opted by the Republicans, if you want to talk about it in that language? And I saw just a couple of days ago an email that was sent out by, I'm not sure whether it was Occupy Wall Street or who, but it was one of the Occupy folks saying, we are not interested in having any part in the Democratic Party in electoral politics. And it was very rational and sort of refreshing the way they, and just very smart the way they were writing and thinking about it. And then at the same time, you think, okay, so what is the next step in terms of, because of course, a lot of what we have is a failed legislative, a failed governmental system that's so influenced by politics. You do, I mean, short of having another American Revolution and starting all over from scratch, which I don't think very many people want to do, because we do have, in many ways, a perfectly reasonable constitution and Bill of Rights and all of that. What is the next step?
Good question. I mean, in terms of the Democrats, I think precisely the reason we saw all these attacks starting on Occupy movements about 2 weeks ago, in the middle of November, where you saw the biggest occupations shut down in Portland, in Oakland, in New York City, and dozens of smaller ones, is because the Democrats were realizing we can't co-opt it. They were trying to do that originally, but then suddenly Obama went silent, and you saw all these Democratic, most of these mayors were Democrats who were attacking these occupation movements. So they're not going to be able to co-opt it in the same way. But at the same time, the occupation movement has been remarkably successful. It's completely changed the national terms of the debate, from austerity, cutting Social Security and Medicare. Of course, that idea is still out there with this idiotic super committee that just failed. But now everyone's talking about inequality and corruption of democracy and the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling and corporate control, and that any successful movement has to have a relation to electoral politics. This is not, we're not all going to run off into the woods and build our log cabins. It's not about separatism. We have to change this system. But to enter the Democratic Party would be suicide. The Democratic Party is a graveyard of social movements. All successful social movements have been from the outside and have used their position from the outside to influence the whole national political debate and culture. Movements move the whole system. Elections are just about moving one party or usually moving one candidate. So during the 1950s, Eisenhower pretty much accepted the whole New Deal structure. I called Nixon the last great liberal president. This is the guy who gave us, the Occupational Safety and Health Act. He gave us EPA, Endangered Species, Clean Air, Clean Water. He put in place an affirmative action program. He kind of mildly attempted to do a fair housing program under actually Mitt Romney's father. He had wage and price controls. He proposed a national health care system that was far better than anything even Clinton proposed 20 years, and we're not even going to talk about Obama's, which is terrible. At one point, Nixon proposed a national income.
This is
tricky dick. The guy who is essentially going around the world committing genocide in Cambodia, overthrowing Allende, the what was going on in Indonesia and all over the place. And it wasn't because he was some great liberal. It was because he was playing for the center. And after 40 years of liberal successes, of left successes, the country was much more supportive.
That was the center.
That was where the center was at. And so now we have to understand Obama, who is fundamentally, he's a right-wing president. He's to the right of Ronald Reagan, if you look at his policies. His policies are pretty much a continuation of the Bush administration policies, because the Democrats accept where the center is at. So it's the job of social movements to move the center, and that's where Occupy Wall Street has already been successful, and that's why it needs to avoid electoral politics like the plague.
Unfortunately, it is time to go, but I want to thank you both so much for being here. Arun Gupta is a founding editor of The Independent, which is a real newspaper on paper. It can also be found on the web at independent.org. That's INDY. And he is regular commentator on Democracy Now! And he and Michelle Fawcett, who is an adjunct professor of media, culture, and communications at NYU, are traveling around the country covering the Occupy movement for Alternate and Salon. And you can read a lot of the articles. I was just reading a bunch of them last night. You can read a lot of the articles already, and we will look forward to them as they keep on coming up on the web. And by the way, you can also find them at OccupyUSAToday.com. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.